female mosquitoes bite because they need blood to produce eggs and further their species. The necessary biology is hard to conjure, though, when you're huddled under bed sheets trying to get some sleep. Like fingernails on a blackboard, the wing-produced whine of a mosquito pokes the psyche as effectively as its proboscis does the skin. For relief from the annoyance, sting, and itch of mosquito bites, village residents keep Alaska's short summers in mind and buy anything and everything they can to keep the bugs at bay.
We stock quite a variety of everything from cutter off, muscle, bins, pick, buick.
Bug jackets with matching pants. I also have a new item that I started carrying last year called Skeeter Eater, and that's been pretty effective. That plugs into your outlets and releases a vapor, I believe, that kills the bugs.
McGrath retailers Mark Melton and Linda Shelbourne report excellent sales of the latest mosquito-fighting products this month, but the interior's Athabascan people were coping with bugs long before DEET and no-see-em netting were around. Traditionally, respite was sought in the smoke of punky birchwood fires under layers of clothing and by clearing brush. Locally occurring plants like mint also have natural repellent qualities. Early bug dopes consisted of muds and later lard mixed with the commercial product Buhack. A mixture similar to the latter is widely used on sled dogs today. Without such care, moose, caribou, and other wild warmbloods are only protected by dense fur or feathers and have to seek refuge in water, mud, and wind. Still they suffer, and old-timers tell stories of bears running mad from swarms of bugs. Interior Alaska has the conditions ideal to produce such hordes, but they don't last long. Mosquitoes will begin to taper this month and virtually disappear by September. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Ice and rocks constantly shower down the narrow gullies that mark Mount Hunter's slopes. In one of them, 20-somethings Chuck Drake and Joshua Hain tried their luck. Today, the rocks and ice continue falling, but Drake and Hain are dead, their colorful packs resting on the snow below. The two men left 2 weeks ago on a 4-day trip attempting to blaze a new trail up 4,000 feet of sheer rock. At 14,573 feet, Mount Hunter is short compared to its more popular neighbor, but Park Service spokeswoman Chris Pfister says compared to Mount McKinley, it offers different, some say more difficult, challenges.
It's very steep, technical, hazardous terrain. Definitely requires special equipment, technical expertise. Technical, just having to use ropes and other equipment, ice screws. It's not something you can just walk up. Looking at Hunter, a lot of it looks like it involves more ice and rock versus some of the perhaps more often used routes on Denali.
Drake and Hain were due back a week ago. When they failed to show, the Park Service with 30 people and several aircraft started searching. On Monday, they spotted what they believed to be Drake's body, suspended by a rope on the mountain wall. Park Ranger J.D. Sled says dangerous conditions leave the Park Service with no plans to recover what's left.
We set up a couple of observers out there, and within 2 hours they saw several big ice falls come raining down on that location. So we're not willing to put people, you know, climbing up to them in that situation. Put a helicopter in there would be a great risk because it just takes a quarter-sized piece of ice falling down through the rotor to have a catastrophe there.
While hundreds of people have summited McKinley this year, only 27 even attempted Hunter. None made it. And these two deaths join those of two Germans, bringing to 4 the number of people killed on Hunter this year. Sled calls Hunter extremely difficult, and he predicts more people will continue to die on its slopes because, unlike McKinley, with its beaten path, Hunter's challenge makes its victory even sweeter.
Freedom is part of climbing. The fact that you can choose your route, how much exposure you want, how much risk you want to put, that's always been the call of the mountains. People are looking at things different. They want to touch the summits rather than just experience the outing. And it's important for folks to remember they're responsible for their own decisions in the backcountry and should do that without requiring any rescue of any kind.
And that freedom is exactly what Drake was looking for. He said as much in an email sent to his friends just before he left. It said, "Josh Hain and I are going up to Alaska to see what North America looks like from the top. So close the blinds on the north sides of your houses because we're bringing binoculars. Wish us thick air and thin gravity." In Talkeetna, I'm Kai Plaskon.
An estimated 3,000 aquatic organisms travel in ships' ballast water tanks each day. Most of them cause no apparent harm to the ports receiving the ballast, but the zebra mussel, introduced to the Great Lakes from Eastern Europe, is an example of an exotic species that can cause harm. It has clogged water intake pipes and destroyed local species spawning beds. Project Assistant Leanne Ferry says the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council wants to make sure exotic species don't harm the ecosystem here.
A non-indigenous species could compete for food resources. It's also been known that certain diseases, fish diseases, could be transported in this way, and so that's obviously a concern for the Prince William Sound area.
The federal government requires the tankers to exchange their ballast water far from shore. However, RCAC believes the ballast water exchange program may not solve the problem. The group says organisms could cling to the ballast tanks or hull and also survive in ballast water held in crude oil storage tanks. Some of that so-called dirty ballast can be exchanged at sea. The rest is treated at the Valdez Marine Terminal. Dr. Ray Jakubczyk, a biologist for BP, says the ballast water exchange is sufficient given the level of risk. He says oil tankers from foreign ports and the Caribbean have deballasted in Valdez before with no apparent consequences. Jakubczyk says the risk is lower for Valdez because the export trade ballast comes from the same ocean and because Valdez is a cold water port receiving warm water ballast. He says the next steps would be filtering the ballast or using chemicals to kill the potentially dangerous organisms.
But you wouldn't want to do that. Would you want that kind of, that large quantities of chemicals being discharged into Port Valdez? Probably not. And you certainly wouldn't want to run it through the ballast water treatment plant. You know, the level of risk out there just doesn't justify an activity that would bring more risk itself.
Jakubczyk says BP will keep its eye on invasive species research in case additional steps become necessary. Barges and cruise ships may also carry exotic species to Prince William Sound. To help fight the problem, Leanne Ferry recommends RCAC support the National Invasive Species Act.
What it would do is it would set up voluntary ballast water guidelines for exchange, for ballast water exchange for all vessels operating beyond the exclusive economic zone of the United States. So whereas what RCAC has done up till now with regard to the export ban has dealt with tankers that leave the terminal for foreign ports only, this bill would cover all vessels that are going in and out of U.S. waters.
The act would also determine the effectiveness of invasive species protections throughout the country, specifically including Prince William Sound. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
It was in a couloir or ice and snow-filled gully, just a bit to the side of the planned route for these two individuals. We are assuming it's one of the two climbers that we've been looking for. Identity is uncertain at this time due to the hazardous location of the body, and we're not sure if we'll be able to recover it or not. The two rangers that were stationed at one of the observation sites noticed at least 12 avalanches that came down in the course of the day yesterday, so it would be extremely hazardous to put an individual closer to the body to get a better look.
The industry standard for clearances in the suspension, if you will, on this type of passenger car is not appropriate for the Alaska Railroad because of the amount of curvature that we have. So we're going to loosen it a little bit, and we're quite sure that that's going to solve the problem.
Most people don't think of the military when the word environmentalist is used, but people at Fort Wainwright aren't ashamed to use it to describe themselves. Fort Wainwright Green Star Coordinator Bob Gray says everybody there is trying to be environmentally friendly.
You know, we're winning the war when you see troopers, when they pull into a field exercise, get out, and right after they chalk the tires on the truck, they pull out drip pans if they know that truck has a little bit of an oil leak, and put the drip pans underneath the vehicle. And when they break up the site and start to leave, they make sure there aren't any oil spills or anything there that's going to be a problem.
Gray says individual units distribute barrels to collect aluminum cans in the workplace and at home. Soldiers and civilians take monthly environmental awareness training and a handbook developed there is now being used Army-wide. Fairbanks Green Star coordinator Sandy McClintock says businesses should know that reusing and recycling can save money, as she and her chamber co-workers have discovered.
All of us out there who aren't on email still take the written phone message, and we go through who knows how many phone message pads. We also have a lot of paper that's waste on one side, but very clean on the other. And Donna in our office has taken our simple pink message pads and put them down on a Xerox machine and run through reused paper on the back side. So now we all use white message slips instead of pink, but we have eliminated that cost from our supply budget and reused the paper.
To earn a Green Star, businesses must adopt standards like conserving paper and reducing the use of hazardous materials. McClintock says the Green Star program also seeks to serve as the recycling center of Fairbanks.
Green Star kind of looks at its mission as a data bank, a central source, the place to come, if you will, to find out what's happening in our community regarding recycling, reusing materials, reducing materials in businesses or at home. And there's a lot of people interested, but we haven't really identified one central business, community, organization, government office that really maintains all of this on a regular basis. And it's ever-evolving, ever-changing, and it seemed the ideal role for a program like Green Star.
The Green Star program was born in Anchorage in 1990 when the Chamber of Commerce and the DEC brainstormed ways businesses can reduce waste. Since then, about 75 of the almost 300 businesses enrolled in that chapter have earned the star. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher. Caltech fisherman Richard Burnham says he's been getting a steady price for chum roe this year, with buyers paying around $3.25 a pound. Three roe processors compete for the Lower Yukon District's harvest. Burnham says the expansion of the Anvik River chum roe limit has drawn some fishermen away from the Yukon River. Fishers can only set nets or use fish wheels in one district at a time.
What's done is it made additional poundage available to be harvested by people in the more upper areas of Y4A, like Nalato and Caltag and up to Kaikuk there. So it's been good in that way, because there's been a long time since the fishing has been fairly good up in this area, because the roe cap was always reached so early that there wasn't much fishing time for anybody.
Recently, managers switched from 3 12-hour openers per week to 2 18-hour shifts, so subsistence fishermen would have more time. Burnham says that schedule is harder.
The 18-hour opening, if it's heavy, is a tough opening to do, because it's not so much just the fishing time, but it's all the handling of the fish, and then plus when you're done, as soon as you turn off the wheel, you still got all those fish to be cut and hung and everything else, so it means more than 18 hours of work.
Usually Lower Yukon fishermen cut and dry chum fish for dog food. Burnham says the search for buyers continues, but markets are depressed for even the brightest, shiniest ocean chum. The Department of Fish and Game has been monitoring the catch closely as the roe cap is neared. Fishermen have caught about 145,000 pounds of chum roe so far. The limit is 183,000 pounds. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
After years of absence, biologists and locals were surprised by the return of thousands of chum salmon to the Tekatna River in the mid-90s. Last year, the village's charter school and the Department of Fish and Game took up an effort to find out just how many chums were coming back. This summer, the school has hired 9 students to count fish from riverside towers. McGrath School sophomore Dusty Parker was among 15 other area students who participated in a school-sponsored salmon camp last month. The Tekatna camp was scheduled to coincide with the height of the chum run.
And there were no fish. At the end of the 2 weeks that we were there, the fish started showing up.
Salmon campers never really got to count fish, as chums began moving up the Tekatna later than expected. As of July 6th, an estimated 1,000-plus chum salmon had made their way past the village on their journey upstream to spawn. Paid students are remaining on duty around the clock to count them until school resumes later this month. Overseeing fisheries biologist Doug Molyneux says predicting the arrival of fish stocks is tricky science, and that studies like Tacotinus must be conducted over many years and include fish aging to really enable biologists to forecast the size and timing of a given chum run.
Chum salmon typically return to spawn either as 4-year-old fish or as 5-year-old fish. And it seems like the 5-year-old component comes in first, and then the 4-year-old component comes in, you know, later. In any particular year, if you happen to have a very, very strong 5-year-old component, it might make the run timing look relatively early. But if, on the other hand, if you have a weak 5-year-old component and a strong 4-year-old component, then it's going to make the run timing look late.
When the Tacanda River's first of two chum runs is complete later this month, the student salmon numbers and data will be logged and crunched by fish and game biologists, giving them an idea of the run size and timing, and possibly helping them manage future stocks on the Kuskokwim.
If the fish that are going to the Tacotna River, if they're coming into the Kuskokwim, we need to know that, because when we have commercial fishing period, we will know what stocks are being exploited by the fishermen at that time, so that management can do more of a stock management rather than just looking at the whole Kuskokwim River and saying, oh, well, a chum salmon is a chum salmon is a chum salmon.
If their good fortune continues, the Tacotna School should keep helping Molyneux and the Department of Fish and Game with research. Much of Tacotna's 1996 salmon project funding comes from a $30,000 Bering Sea Fishermen's Association grant. School principal Bart Mowry is hopeful that future such monies will enable his school to continue, if not expand, its salmon work. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
The state licenses three types of guides. A master guide must pass an exam and meet experience requirements. The other two types, Class A and assistant guides, work for a master. Class A guides are more experienced and are residents of the game unit areas where they work, while assistant guides only need 2 years of hunting experience. The new law pressures master guides to hire Class A guides by regulating the amount of independence each can have in the field. Division of Commercial Licensing Director Catherine Reardon says the proposed regulations set parameters for how often master guides have to check up on their workers.
One of the jobs the division has in the regulations is to be more specific about what types of supervision are required for assistant guides, and we have done that. The emergency regulations, which are out for public comment, require that the registered guide be in contact with an assistant guide once every 3 days. And that is one of the issues that I expect guides may have some comments on.
The law also directs the division to discipline incompetent guides. Reardon says the permanent regulations must define competency.
We've talked about things like not providing sufficient first aid, food and shelter to your clients, not correctly tagging animals, not ensuring your clients have hunting permits, things like that. But that's another area where the public could help us to define incompetence well, so that we really will be disciplining people who perform badly as guides, and yet we don't aren't unnecessarily harsh on people who are doing things that really aren't dangerous.
Guides need landowner permission to hunt in an area. In last year's actions, the legislature removed language that required them to prove it. Reardon says the division won't police that rule either. Not everyone's happy with the new process. Fairbanks guide and former guide board member Pete Buist says the Division of Occupational Licensing isn't equipped to deal with the guide industry. He says it shows in the proposed regulations.
When I look at them, I see, well, here's something that obviously was written by somebody who has very little information about what goes on in the field and no experience at what goes on in the field, and that's kind of disappointing. That's something that we had when we had a guide board or a whatever the various boards were called, the Big Game Commercial Services Board or the old Guide Licensing and Control Board. We had people who were involved in the industry and knew what was really going on out in the backcountry, and now we don't have that.
The public comment period for hunting guide regulations ends Friday. The regulations will be made permanent this September. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
A meeting in Galena will determine if there's help for the Air Force in its effort to clean up contamination on the lower Yukon River. Thousands of barrels of toxic waste were spread over lower Yukon wetlands. thrown there by devastating spring floods in 1945 and 65. Roger Poppe in State Representative Irene Nikolai's office says it'll take interagency cooperation at all levels of government to make the cleanup work. The gathering this Friday will do something that hasn't been done before: bring together the people affected by the spills and the government agencies who can do something about it. The Loudoun Village Council Director of Natural Resources, Steve Houdyshell, says the meeting is taking place because of the state legislature.
Representative Irene Nikolai's office has responded to a tribal resolution that we passed in April declaring the area around Galena, Campion, and Kallikakit Creek as an environmental disaster. And this has been the response from the Alaska State Legislature, is to pull together this meeting to address that resolution.
Since the affected area covers over 300 square miles of state, tribal, federal, and private land, Poppe says other agencies like the Bureau of Land Management, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the Army Corps of Engineers, among others, can assist in the cleanup effort. If the agencies attending the meeting reach a consensus on the cleanup, the same formula could be used at other spill sites. Reporting from Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
There's no hay to be bought anywhere in the state. Alaska feed company owner John Underwood says his family's business usually buys hay from Alaskan farmers.
We've been asking all of our normal suppliers and people that we've done business with in the past, and nobody has any. And there aren't any good prospects at this point either. Normally there's a first cutting in around the end of June, and there's a second cutting around the end of August, first part of September. And at this point, I think most farmers are holding on and hoping they're going to get a decent second cutting out of it.
Underwood says the Alaskan hay crop is a third shorter than usual. It's also starting to go to seed, which means it will lose its nutritional value. So farmers are faced with low product quantity and quality. Oats, barley, and other grain are harvested in August, but those also look bad. State Agriculture Director Jay Kurtula says shortages in Delta Junction, the Mat-Su Valley, and the Kenai Peninsula prompted Governor Knowles to declare a crop disaster.
He wants us to get into the livestock feed program and the non-insured assistance program. And some of these crops, like potatoes, you can insure for crop disaster, but hay you cannot. So you have to get in the NAP program there. Livestock feed production program also is of great interest.
The governor is also requesting that Alaska be included in legislation designed to provide one-time cash support for farmers suffering from drought losses. The governor's office is waiting to hear from the U.S. Agriculture Department regarding these requests. Kurtula says the help should come from the federal government. He says the state is not set up to provide funds for emergency crop loss, but he says it can provide low-interest loans and extended repayment periods. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Three, two, one. Fairbanks Birch Works owner Bob Zackles long pleaded for a steady supply of timber to run his sawmill and dry kiln. The bill Governor Knowles recently signed should allow Zackles that opportunity, so he's not waiting around. Last week, he filed a proposal with the Division of Forestry to negotiate a 10-year timber sale.
Well, now I'm doing, volume-wise, let's say 50 to 70,000 board feet per year of kiln-dried birch. And I've requested a sale for 500,000 board feet of birch timber. I'd like to be able to take it to a sustained production of things like flooring, paneling, moldings. And I feel that it's necessary to have a larger supply so to justify the capital expense.
Zackle figures he'd have to spend several $1,000s to upgrade his business. He's looking for 13-inch birch within a 50-mile radius of Fairbanks and says he could hire 6 to 9 skilled workers. Nearly all of the products he makes are sold locally, so if he expands, Anchorage would be a natural market.
I certainly feel that in-state there would be no problem. Having that much consumed, Anchorage has roughly 10 times the population of Fairbanks. So I don't think it'll be a problem to use 500,000 board feet per year in-state.
Zackel's hoping to start harvesting the year after next, and state foresters expect they'll need close to a year to write new regulations and schedule a timber sale. While Zackel's so far the only interior business to submit a proposal under the new law, Ron Ricketts of the Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation says he's working with two outside companies considering investing in the area.
One company is Alcee Veneer, and it's a matter of public record that they've had some interest. They're probably looking at $6 to $7 million in investment. That's a real rough estimate. The other company, they're out of Idaho, and their interest is more in the White Spruce Dimension Lumber area.
Ricketts isn't releasing the name of this second company, but says of the little he knows about it, it's about the same size as the veneer plant. The next steps for the companies will be assessing the feasibility of investing in the state. That includes evaluating markets, construction, transportation, and labor costs. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Oil exploration in Alaska has been mostly contained to the North Slope and Cook Inlet, but new state policy should make the interior and other areas more attractive. Geophysicist Jim Hansen says the state has tried to conduct lease sales in the interior, but didn't have much success. That should change with the adoption of the exploration licensing program.
The difference between this and leasing is, in leasing, they normally pay a bonus payment to the state for the right to go in and explore an area. That could be anywhere from $5 to $10 an acre minimum, or anything above that they may bid for the privilege. Exploration licensing does away with that bonus, and simply the company informs us how much money they are going to spend on exploration, and that the company who is going to spend the most on exploration in a certain area gets the right to license that area, and then that money is spent for exploration.
For 1 month each year, companies can submit proposals for 10-year exploration contracts on parcels from 10,000 to 500,000 acres. Then other companies may bid, with the license going to the project worth the most. During the rest of the year, the state will identify specific areas up for bid. Hansen says companies have the option of converting the license to a lease at any time if they find something worth developing. Lands open to licensing include the Tanana, Susitna, and Copper River basins, portions of Cook Inlet, and the Alaska Gulf. ARCO Alaska has already put in a proposal to explore near Yakutat. Spokesman Ronnie Chappell says the company's been waiting for the state to start the program, which other countries have been using for years. He says one of the problems with oil development in Alaska has been getting access to land. Chappell agrees that the licensing program could bring oil development to the interior.
We don't comment on oil, you know, prospective oil and gas areas, or where we're looking, or where we think there might be oil and gas. This is the kind of program that industry will find attractive when considering, you know, the interior of Alaska, where the chances of commercial discovery are smaller than they would be in south central Alaska or on the North Slope in areas near existing fields. And where transportation, you know, to market is already available.
With interior and other lands more available, the state is touting this program as an opportunity for small business. But Fairbanks land consultant Cliff Berglund says the licensing program will just give the established companies more access to Alaskan oil and gas.
Alaska is competing with the other states, you know, to sell oil and gas. All this would do would allow the big companies to tie up large blocks of land, you know, forever.
Berglund says smaller companies can't compete since they'll have to be bonded for the amount of the project. The DNR's Hansen says the companies will determine how much they'll spend and be bonded for that amount. If they don't spend what they promised, the balance of the bond would be forfeited to the state. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
With trash scattered over several acres in the past, McGrath's landfill never qualified for a Department of Environmental Conservation permit, but that may be changing. Mayor Glenn Hanway says $600,000 in Village Safe Water Fund grant monies from the state have allowed the city to significantly upgrade the landfill over the last year, making possible a Class 3 permit from DEC.
We've got a new retaining wall that's steel so it can't burn down, and got a new fencing and enough cover material to keep it covered, and also a new septic disposal site.
Hanway says the city has filed for a permit from the state despite the McGrath landfill's location within the floodplain. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation environmental specialist Jim Frischon inspected the landfill last month. He says flooding is a concern, but that an earlier study by the city determined relocation of the dump to be just too expensive. Frischon thinks the city is making the best of its situation by building up the current site with trucked-in fill, and that McGrath is likely to be permitted as a Class 3 landfill with minimal additional improvements.
I think the chances are pretty good. You know, basically we're just working with the community on maybe attempting to establish a hazardous material collection point to where, you know, the people segregate out their batteries, waste oil, any solvent, paint material type stuff like that, so it's not deposited in the landfill.
Frischon says once McGrath's landfill becomes an approved Class 3 site, it will be expected to upgrade to comply with tighter Class 2 regulations within 10 years. Meanwhile, if a coal and solid waste-fired power generation facility proposed for McGrath is constructed, the city's solid waste volume could be lessened significantly. The cooperatively researched and funded multi-million dollar project could become reality within a year. It's currently being considered by the federal and state government and the area's native corporations. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
The DEC program coordinator for Northern Alaska says the Federal Environmental Protection Agency is trying to get rid of open dumps. EPA regulations passed over the last 5 years also prohibit landfills in floodplains and too close to airfields. DEC's Chris McCombie says her agency has taken those federal regulations and adapted them for Alaska.
For the small community landfills, we have tried to get more flexibility, recognizing that we have some unique situations in rural Alaska that are very difficult to apply the same standards to those communities as you would to a community of a comparable size in lower 48. And so there are we've developed different classes of landfills for the state.
DEC set up three classes of municipal waste sites. The more strictly regulated Class 1 landfills are found in large communities like Fairbanks, while the agency allows leeway for Class 3 landfills located in small communities off the road system. McCombie oversees all landfills north of the Alaska Range. She says there are 50 Class 3s in her area. 45 of them are unpermitted.
We have a number of situations where people are not in compliance with our state regulations, and we try to work on a one-on-one situation with those communities to bring them into better compliance with our state regs and hopefully also make it better for the community.
Galena City Manager Chal Taylor knows the road to getting a DEC landfill permit is a tough one. In fact, sometimes the road has to be built. Galena is lucky, though. When the state informed the community that their current landfill was illegal, the Air Force offered to give them land for a new site. But Taylor says it's off the community's one road, which is in bad shape, and the city can't afford to fix it.
We're asking for some emergency money. We're asking the state to reroute part of it as a quick fix. We're on the state's transportation improvement plan for construction and repair for the year 2001, but it's not going to last that long.
Beaver is an example of a community with a new Class 3 landfill and no road leading to it. City Administrator Wilma Pitka says DOT hasn't started constructing the new road yet, although there is a four-wheeler trail which the villagers use regularly. Beaver residents began building their new landfill after severe flooding caused them to close the old one. Taylor says it's a lack of money that keeps rural communities from complying with the federal regulations.
You have to go begging for money, pleading for money. You know, this is an unfunded mandate by the federal government that they're telling us we have to do. You know, and we've told them that we'll do the best we can, but know, got the money, can't do what they tell you you're supposed to do. But we're trying.
DEC's McCombie says the agency encourages communities with illegal landfills to come up with creative solutions to their solid waste disposal problems. She says her agency would rather see money spent on improvements than fines. DEC expects to issue a permit for Galena's new landfill in the months ahead. McCombie says some communities will never qualify for a permit because of their location. But she says as long as they continue to work towards better handling of their waste, the DEC will work with them. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
The permit covers the plant's discharges of treated ballast water to Port Valdez, also known as effluent. The effluent limits for benzene and other aromatic hydrocarbons are lower in the new permit, but Alyeska's ballast water team leader, Rex Brown, says that shouldn't affect the actual discharges.
The limits are more stringent, but they're reasonable. Right now, the permit would say that you can discharge up to a part per million, and we're consistently less than one-tenth of that limit.
EPA Representative Ann Daly says in 20 years of monitoring, there's no evidence of harm to the port from the ballast treatment plant. But the new permit requires more emphasis on pollution prevention and new monitoring procedures, including toxicity tests of the effluent and hydrocarbon monitoring in sediments near the discharge pipe. The permit resulted from talks between EPA, Alyeska, the State Department of Environmental Conservation, RCAC, the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, and other groups. Daly says they didn't agree on everything, but the cooperative process worked well.
Individually, I think all the pieces together are good, but once you pile, you know, the limits together and the monitoring requirements and the BMP and pollution prevention requirements together with the environmental monitoring, and there's also a requirement for a quality assurance plan to be developed so that the test results that are provided are assured to be, you know, quality results. When you pile it all together, that it's a really good permit. It's a good package.
RCAC spokeswoman Patty Ginsburg says the group process resulted in a better product, but that doesn't mean RCAC is totally pleased. She says some of what the citizens group wanted made it in, but other suggestions failed.
One of the things that we had requested was more sensitive monitoring. We had suggested that it would make sense to look at certain creatures in the sediments, like sea urchins, to look not just at whether they live or die, but whether they grow and reproduce. And if you're looking at growth and reproduction, that's a more sensitive test than just whether they're living or dying. The EPA did discuss that, and they decided that it was premature. They decided not to require that in the permit.
RCAC did succeed in its request for monitoring based on hypotheses.
What that means is they decide what questions they're going to ask, what information they're seeking from the monitoring before they seek the answers. And that was something that was important to us, that figure out what it is you're trying to determine, and then in your monitoring program, go for those answers. And that makes the monitoring more focused.
Ginsburg says RCAC and its consultants will closely review the draft permit and make detailed comments by the September 9th deadline. The EPA hopes to finalize the five-year permit soon thereafter. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
This little one right up here. It's a cherry tomato. And it's turning red. We can't pick it yet. We have to wait till it turns completely red, and then we can pick it.
Oh, show me.
And when it's time to pick, I'll let you pick it. But it's not time yet. What do you like to pick that's red, Evie?
I don't know.
What do you like to pick over there that's red? Over there.
Oh, a strawberry.
Yeah. And here's the pumpkin. If we find the pumpkin that's gone, maybe we'll get a pumpkin this year. We've never got one before. I don't know. It's just a teeny little green pumpkin starting to grow. Very little. But look, there's a zucchini here. We can grow. We can pick. We can pick that later today.
The Loudoun Village Council brought several federal and state agencies to Galena for a meeting to see if there are other ways to pay for the cleanup. The council and the public found out the Air Force is the only government agency able to provide money for the project. Lately, there hasn't been very much money to pick up barrels or fix soils contaminated by jet fuel. The Air Force did tell the crowd of about 30 people there will be $1.4 million to pay for barrel cleanup in 1997. Steve Houdyshell at Loudoun Village Council says Congress has freed up another $21 million for barrel cleanup nationwide. Houdyshell believes a lot of that money will be coming to Alaska for Galena and King Salmon. Virginia Perry is the chief of the Loudoun Village Council. At the meeting, she told the Air Force no one in the tribe has any trust in the Air Force and would only believe what they say if there is more than one government agency present.
It's not to say that we're blaming the Air Force, we're blaming BLM, that doesn't really matter. We all need to get together, we need to work with this, we need to unite and to pull, because the only people that we're trying to save now are the children that are upcoming. For us, maybe there is no hope, because most of the people in my age group is in the 40s and 50s are dying of cancer at a young age. I know I have three sisters who have cancer, and it's an ongoing battle for them.
The tribal council says they did get assurances from the Air Force the tribe would be high on the list to receive cleanup contracts. Reporting from Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
Alaska's short growing season is more than half over now, and gardeners are busy coaxing their summer's crops along in preparation for next month's harvest fairs. Dan Bross reports from McGrath. 3, 2, 1. Low-angle sun finds its way between patchy clouds across the dogyard as my wife Peggy and son Avon peek behind the cloudy plastic of the cold frame at baby tomatoes bathed in moist warmth. Like many village gardeners, they take pride in the vegetables the interior can yield with the right amounts of potting soil, fertilizer, and water. A break from expensive store-bought produce, gardens are as much a means of getting by as salmon, moose, and firewood. But it's the wonder and pride of vegetable plants that were just tiny seeds in April that attracts moms, dads, and two-year-olds to the garden. With the midnight sun waning, gardeners are estimating how much time is left for growth. A month from now, like many communities, Upper Kuskokwim area residents will come together to share and show their summer's harvest.
The McGrath Fair this summer will be the 17th consecutive. The fair has always been primarily a place for people to bring what they produce, the different vegetables, the different varieties of things that people produce in their gardens. And they're judged according to appearance and display and size.
In his 17th year helping to organize the yearly celebration of life on the Kuskokwim, McGrath Cooperative Extension agent Francis Mitchell is quick to remind that the fair is about more than local produce. Livestock, arts, crafts, food, and entertainment share the prizes and ribbons. But for many, it's the homegrown vegetables and flowers that identify a given year's fair as a reflection of the summer gardeners worked with.
It seems to me that it's been a little slow this year. Cooler and late start. But every time when we set the fair date, we always wonder, well, how will this be in terms of gardens? But you never know, because something that happens early in the summer is compensated by something that happens later in the summer.
This year's McGrath Fair is scheduled for August 17th. With under a month to go now, area gardeners are taking stock and enjoying the ride, hoping that maybe, just maybe, that pumpkin will be ready come fair time. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Fishermen could once count on Coghill Lake for hundreds of thousands of red salmon. In 1987, the return was 603,000. Just 3 years later, the return had plummeted to about 20,000. Fish and Game believes too many fish in the lake depleted the plankton, leaving future generations not enough to eat and thrive. With funds from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, the department started fertilizing the lake in 1993. Trustee Council Science Coordinator Stan Senner calls the program a success.
Our view, based on the information provided by the Department of Fish and Game, is that the plankton productivity in the lake is now back at an acceptable level, and that a good number of smolts are being produced. And at least in 1995, the escapement of adults coming back was above the targeted level, and we'll see here quite soon, I guess, what happens in 1996, but at least the projection is for a good return as well.
The return was close to 100,000 last year and projected to be 220,000 this year. Fish and Game has asked the Trustee Council for $220,000 to continue the program one more year, but Council staff is recommending the program end. Fish and Game scientist Dana Schmidt says they want to fertilize the lake again and continue monitoring the results.
What we really like to do is evaluate once we quit. So the responses which we've seen on the lake, which have been fairly positive in terms of increase of primary production, that is the small microscopic plants that grow in the water column of the lake, we've seen a positive response with those, and we like to see when we quit fertilization whether or not the levels continue for a couple years after or whether or not they immediately decrease.
Schmidt says that information would give the department a longer-term perspective on the program's effectiveness, but Center says the Trustee Council scientists are satisfied the lake can now sustain itself.
In the view of the scientific reviewers that we have, who are all outside reviewers, you know, independent of Department of Fish and Game or anything, in their judgment, the objectives have been met, and we should be able to stop it after this season.
The Trustee Council will consider the Cog Hill Lake Restoration Funding as part of the 1997 work plan. The group may act on the plan next month.
In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
Three, two, one. The hope is in a drug cocktail, including the new class of drugs called protease inhibitors. They actually seem to beat back the unbeatable HIV virus. In Fairbanks, they're offering an unexpected lease on life. Dr. Michael Heinley has been treating his patients with the drugs since they became available a few months ago. While it's too soon to tell about the long term, he says there is reason to celebrate.
Until now, we've been largely buying time. We knew that the medicines we were using would buy a little time, but over time they would become ineffective. And we've just been hoping that something would come along, something which would transform the face of the treatment of HIV, and it looks like this is it. Now my patients and I are talking about the distant future and about long-range plans. That's a tremendously exciting change.
Long-range planning may seem like a conflict in terms for people with HIV, but Bonnie McCorkadale, who directs the Interior AIDS Association, says people who've been very ill are feeling better. Some who've settled their affairs and resigned themselves to dying have talked about returning to work.
It is a profound change in terms of living with HIV. It is a remarkable and wonderful thing that will make this, in all likelihood, a manageable disease that will provide a quality of life unknown to people who were facing it in the past.
McCorkadale says she anticipates some stress, even at the good news, as people with HIV adjust themselves to fuller lives and also to ongoing expensive treatments. This new combination of drugs, including the protease inhibitors, can cost as much as $2,000 a month.
Certainly, as in any long-term chronic condition that is potentially or actually disabling, there are lots and lots of issues about being able to support yourself, being able to maintain your family, being able to maintain those areas and those life skills that are so important to us, but that people with chronic conditions frequently can't maintain.
Dr. Heinley says right now most of his patients are insured or are on Medicaid.
So there has been nobody that I have had that has not been able to afford it. It has certainly been a crunch for people who have to contribute a portion of the cost of the medications. But I think looking at the benefit that my patients get and the cost, there's no question that this is the right thing to do at the right time.
The Interior AIDS Association is receiving about $20,000 in federal monies this year to help defray medically related costs for people with HIV. The grant's nearly six times what they've received in the past, and McCorkadale says they're asking the public to help determine priorities. A public meeting will be held tomorrow at noon at the Fairbanks Regional Public Health Center on Barnett Street. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. Three, two, one. The culprit was the lack of snow early this winter. It allowed a deep freeze just about statewide. By the time significant snows finally fell in February, the freeze had done its work. Fairbanks area forester Pete Bino says when spring came, the cold was deep enough that melting snow and any other moisture just ran off the surface, failing to penetrate the ground.
I think that left us with a pretty dry condition statewide. And we also had a seemed to take a long time this year for things to green up, again from the lack of moisture and the deep freeze, which kept the fire danger higher longer than normal.
Alaska's interior fire season was pretty normal, but elsewhere there were real problems. The state's major fire struck around Big Lake early in June, and Bino said the burn ban went statewide after fires struck in Central, Delta, Tok, and on the Kenai all at once.
And at one point, all 73 crews in the state were all on fires at the same time, so we also had a number of crews in the lower 48 up here.
The large fires, dry conditions, and strained resources had Alaska on alert everywhere except the Aleutians, the southeast, and North Slope. As the season wore on, bans were lifted or amended. The interior's ban remaining on campfires and fireworks finally came off late last week. Normal burn requirements will prevail through September. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Over the past month, several hundred young people have been in Fairbanks taking part in the 33rd annual Summer Fine Arts Camp. This week, as Susan McGinnis reports, they're showing what they've learned in dance, instrumental and vocal music, visual arts, writing, and theater.
Most students at the camp live in Fairbanks, but among the 450 registered this year, there are youngsters from Juneau, the North Slope, and Anchorage, several from the East Coast and Southwest, and a handful from Russia. They're as young as 12 and as old as 18, and they're all at camp to immerse themselves in the arts. Saxophonist and camp director Ted DeCorso says the work they do can teach these young people more than what they've come to study.
Primarily, we hope that they take away a little bit of a better sense of their own individual value as people. Now, we use the arts to get to that. You know, we provide experiences where they can explore the arts, and they can find out the levels of expression that the arts provide for them.
Each of the arts camp students chose a major study for the four-week period. DeCorso says much like a college major, the choice tracks students to courses that complement their primary interests.
So in the morning they'll be working in the area of music and instrumental music, and vocal music, orchestras, what have you. In theater or visual arts, it would be a similar thing where they'd be kind of focusing in that area.
The afternoons and evenings have been devoted to electives to help the teenagers gain breadth as well as depth.
So that students who are primarily have worked in music can find out perhaps what is what the value is of a painting class or of working with prints, you know, or writing, or working in theater, participating in a lab production.
DeCorso, who marks his 21st year with the camp this year, says what students learn there responds to a human desire to share experience. The arts, he says, help teenagers, growing up and on the verge of independence, find and build on ways to communicate.
Rather than by going off and expressing them in some way that's maybe non-productive or doesn't help them or others, we try to give them the tools that they can so that they can express what they're thinking and feeling and valuing to other people.
There's a performance of The Music Man tonight at Salisbury Theater. Tomorrow is the opening for the student art show and dance, jazz, and improvisational theater performances. Friday night, the 33rd Summer Fine Arts Camp holds its final camp concert. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Today is the last day of the UAF Summer Fine Arts Camp. The month-long camp draws teenagers from all around Alaska, as well as lower 48 states and Russia, to study art, music, drama, dance, and creative writing with working artists. This week, some of the teachers talked with KUAC reporters Teresa Bacher and Susan McGinnis about their experiences at the camp. First, Teresa Bacher tells us about three musicians who have a lot in common. They met 3 years ago as finalists of the prestigious Louise McMahon competition in Oklahoma.
Linda Harwell plays the bassoon for a living. She's a member of the National Symphony in Washington, D.C., and she teaches at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. When she came to Fairbanks for her second stint as an instructor at the Fine Arts Camp, she knew she'd be running into at least one of her fellow McMahon competition finalists.
I knew that John Harbaugh was there. I knew, because I knew him before the competition, so when I ran into him down there, I knew that. But I didn't know Scott, of course, and so when I got here and I saw this new percussion teacher, and I thought, oh, he looks familiar. And so I asked him, you know, don't I know you?
Scott Deal, the other Oklahoma finalist, teaches at UAF. This is his first summer at the arts camp. He says the electricity and enthusiasm generated by the kids makes it a great experience for him.
And it creates this buzz in the air, this excitement, this intensity, and especially because the camp is so busy. So many things going on, so many choices, that it's just like a sort of this big internal explosion for a month.
Faculty members forge professional and personal relationships with each other and with the students. Harwell says she's developed several artistic ventures at the Fine Arts Camp.
For instance, last year there was a camper who was a didgeridoo player. His instrument for the camp was trombone. But his real passion is the didgeridoo, and he and I became friends, and he sold me a didgeridoo, and we started playing together, bassoon and didgeridoo, and discovered that this was a really amazing combination. So last September, he came to Washington, and we did three recitals down there. We commissioned a piece for bassoon, didgeridoo, and piano.
So whether participating as students, teachers, or spectators, the Fine Arts Camp at UAF gives meaning by building connections between people and art. Los Angeles muralist and community activist Jose Aguirre says a work of art adds depth to people's lives. A mural or a piece of public sculpture can help people look more closely at the world around them and serve as an antidote to the effects of modern media.
You open their perceptions in a very subtle way. I mean, this is what you see on television right now or in magazines. You're bombarded with so many images that they don't allow you to meditate or to think about what you see anymore, you know. It's like you just look and you don't see.
For Aguirre and the other visual arts teachers at this year's camp, getting students to really see was a primary goal. Los Angeles sculptor Michael Tansey's most recent work has been of flowers, sculpted orchids and daffodils. He's used his own sense of what he calls the visual music in everyday objects to help make students aware of shape and form.
In my class, we're making hamburgers, and the lettuce is drapery. You know, I say, okay, now make it look like a hamburger, but it's a piece of sculpture, so you need to think of the lyrical side of it, but you want it to have sculptural elements. So that's what it is. And a hamburger bun has a wonderful curve to it, and it's a wonderful shape. So it. You know, it's something that these kids have seen a thousand of, and now they're really looking at them.
They're looking, and Tansey says when they're doing it right, they're slowing down.
I think some of the best work is done by the student who understands that it's not done instantly. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these kids come in with the idea of making instant art. If it can't be done in 15 minutes, it can't be done in their minds. And I've been insisting that, you know, it's a process, and it grows, and you do a piece at a time, and you see, you visualize where you're going, and you learn to visualize a goal, and I think that carries over to the rest of their lives.
The artists who've taught at the Fine Arts Camp say they've all had to learn the same lessons of seeing, patience, and receptivity. Fairbanks mask maker Kathleen Carlo says what she's learned comes out in her own work.
Sometimes when I start in on a mask, a lot of it depends on the wood, and then you might have an idea of what you want to do, but it's always, to me, it's always constantly changing. and whether it happens because of a lot of times maybe the grain of the wood, you kind of go make different cuts and things because of the grain of the wood, and you want to bring out that grain in the finished piece. Other times I have no idea what I'm doing, and I just start in, and who knows how it's going to come out.
Carlo teaches year-round and all around Alaska through the Artist in the Schools program. She's winding up her third summer with the Fine Arts Camp. She says not every carving student will become an artist mask maker, but if they discover a pastime that makes them feel good doing it, they've discovered a lot.
The kids are just totally amazed at what their finished product is. They're just, you could just see how proud they are. And so, and then I've got students that I taught last year in sixth grade that came to summer camp this year, and then they're buying tools, and they're doing other carving projects. So it's kind of going on and on with their carving.
And muralist Jose Aguirre says, for the artist teachers, that's the point.
And I think that's what we're trying to do here also, you know, say, hey, there is something that is there that is magical, that you can be the one who creates it and controls it.
The 33rd UAF Summer Arts Camp will come to a close this weekend, and today is the last chance to see student works. There are photography and art exhibits, a presentation of James and the Giant Peach, dance, music recitals, and concerts throughout the day and evening, all in and around UAF's Great Hall. In Fairbanks, with Teresa Bacher, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Horses have to eat hay. They eat it all day long. Hay provides important nutrients like fiber and keeps horses warm from the internal heat generated by the fermentation process in their stomachs. It's hard to find an alternative, although owners can supplement with grains or prepared feeds. Fairbanks barn manager Lori Knutila says these animals eat 15 to 20 pounds of hay each day. She says the hay shortage in the state has horse owners thinking about stretching their supply to get through the winter.
Be conservative with whatever hay you have now and whatever hay you can get. Be conservative with it and try to extend it as much as you can without compromising the horse's health, of course. By using pallets or cubes or something like that, you can extend hay that you have. That would probably be the best thing, is just be as conservative with it as you can.
Livestock owners and farmers rely on a first cutting of hay in June for most of the year's supply. Agriculture Extension agent Don Quarberg says most growers missed the first cutting last month because low snowfall, a late frost, and no spring rain kept growth down.
The stand is so short and so thin that when you mow it, it falls down in the stubble and the rakes can't even pick it up to get a windrow to bale. In fact, there was one person I know that harvested several acres, but he averaged about 90 pounds. That's two bales per acre. There's just nothing there.
Recent rain could spur a growing spurt for the second cutting of the state's hay, usually in early August. But Quarberg says if it rains too long, there won't be adequate time for it to dry.
And the thing that's desirable about cutting that early in August is the days still have sufficient heat, or at least we hope they do, to enable the producer to let that hay dry in the field, and he can bale it as dry hay without fear of it molding. By waiting until now, with the rains spurring on growth now, that will push that second cutting back until late August, early September. And the short days and the morning dew just compounds the problem of attempting to dry it under those conditions.
Hay can be put up in a high moisture form, either as haylage or silage, but those options are only good for livestock owners who grow their own. Quarberg says some Fairbanks horse owners are using wrapped bales of wet hay, but it requires high maintenance to keep it from molding or freezing. Alaskans may be looking for hay outside of the state, but that could cost up to 50% more. Meanwhile, the governor has requested emergency grants and loans from the federal government to help out. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher. I'm Teresa Bacher. Lifelong Ruby resident Katie Kangas says locals suspected Walter all along and shared that information with troopers and postal inspectors.
I'd always heard stories about the Walters and how they were able to walk from the Novi River to the McGrath area, and that they were well acquainted with living out in the woods. They have a reputation for, you know, having that ability.
Kanga says the Walter family was known in Ruby, although she had never met Abram and couldn't give the postal inspector a description. Residents are relieved to hear that a suspect is in custody. Kanga says the investigation divided the community and spread suspicion among neighbors.
We have many people in Ruby that aren't angels, but we knew that somebody in Ruby couldn't commit something so brutal to somebody so well-liked. And it just was too bad that they made Ruby to appear to be such a little sneaky community, because I had people calling me from all over the state and from the lower 48s asking me what was going on in Ruby, because they had heard or read the same thing that we were covering up.
Kanga says life in her community can now return to normal. The only thing Kanga and her neighbors will have to fear as they walk the hilly streets of Ruby is the occasional bear. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
3, 2, 1. A man who is being charged with theft and burglary in communities near Fairbanks has led Alaska State Troopers and Federal Postal Agents back to the Middle Yukon River village of Ruby. Troopers say 23-year-old Abram Paul Walter said he intended to rob Ruby's post office when he went there in mid-June. The robbery went wrong and resulted in the murder of Agnes Wright. Wright was a lifelong resident of Ruby and the village postmaster. Fairbanks Trooper Investigator Ray Gary says the discovery of Walter's connection to the murder came as troopers questioned him regarding thefts in Nenana and in Esther.
He gave us some information yesterday, some leads, where we could locate some evidence from the homicide, and we're currently following up those leads and are going out. We have people in the field right now trying to collect some of the items that he told us about.
Troopers arrested Walter just 22 miles south of Esther Tuesday. He was driving musher Rick Mackey's car and in possession of a gun and other items missing from the Mackey's Nenana residence. The car had been linked to an overnight burglary and a daylight armed robbery of the Esther post office. Walter has been something of a mystery in recent weeks. He disappeared early in June, leaving behind a capsized canoe on the Tekotna River. At about the same time, theft charges were pending against him in McGrath. Townspeople there say he's an experienced woodsman, raised in the bush, capable of walking the 70 or so miles from McGrath to Ruby and then south into the Fairbanks area. Because Ruby's postmaster was a federal employee and was murdered on federal property, Walter is liable to face federal charges on the murder of Agnes Wright, as well as on the burglary and armed robbery of the Esther post office. Trooper Gary says both agencies will continue to investigate.
We've been working since the beginning of this with postal inspectors, and they are some of the people that are out in the field right now, out in the Ruby area. They went out with Sergeant McCann this morning.
Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.